Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the Library Science Channel of New Books Network. My name is Jen Hoyer, and today I'm speaking with Stephen Bales, author, one of the authors of Serapis, The Sacred Library and Its Declericalization. Serapis is published by Library Juice Press and is available for pre-order now. This book explores the historical and legacy religious symbols and rituals in the academic library, referred to here as the Serapian Library. And it explores the academic library as a powerful ideological state institution and investigates how these symbols and rituals support hegemonic structures in society. Stephen Bales is a professor in global languages and cultures at Texas A&M University. Steve, welcome to New Books Network.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So before we start talking about this book, I would love if you could share a little with listeners about your own background, where you grew up and went to university, and what brought you to your work in libraries.
So I grew up in Georgia, in Augusta, Georgia. And then from there, I went to high school in Asheville, North Carolina. After high school, I went to University of Tennessee in Knoxville, Tennessee, where I did my bachelor's, my BA in religious studies. After I did that, I went and got a job and worked for a few years as the night watchman at a mental health care facility for several years. And one night I had a patient punch me in my face in the middle of the night at like 3 a.m. And I realized like a light bulb moment, literally a light bulb moment. And I thought, I've got to get another job. So I went to my computer and I looked for any educational program that could get me that had a job attached to the end of it, unlike religious studies. So I settled on library information science. So I went back to the University of Tennessee in 2002 and did my master's degree there, and just stayed on after that, got my PhD as well in communication and information. I focused on information science and intellectual history. And after that, I became a religion and philosophy and anthropology and some other things librarian at Texas A&M University, where I worked there as a librarian for about 14 years, but then there was some shakeups in the library over the past couple of years, and the librarians lost their faculty status. So that's why I decided, instead of staying, I decided to move to the global languages and cultures, where I now teach religious studies.
Super. Thank you. So shifting now to this book that you co-authored with Wendy Casper, Serapis offers a critique of the modern academic library as a crypto-religious institution. Could you share a little about how this book came to be? Like, what prompted you towards this analysis and what inspired you to write a book about it?
Well, this really started back in library school when I was introduced to some ideas in critical theory. The interim director at the time was Doug Raber, and I believe now he's retired, but he introduced me to like Gramsci's theory of hegemony and really expanded my idea of culture and introduced me to critical theory and method. So when I went to get my, when I was going to do my dissertation, my original idea was to do a dissertation on the library's relationship to religion and through history. That was the original idea. But when I was talking to my dissertation chair, he told me, that sounds like a really, really interesting idea, but you do want a job after you graduate. So instead of that, I did my dissertation on Aristotle and the Library of Alexandria and Aristotle's influence, his philosophy's influence on the Library of Alexandria and libraries after that in scholarly communication. In the process, I really I analyzed Aristotle's dialectical method in relationships to how the Library of Alexandria was operating to create new knowledge, and so which I found fascinating. And after that, I moved from reading about Aristotle's dialectical method to more modern dialectical methods like Hegel, and then I got into Marx's dialectical method as a critique, and I started applying that to the library, and I eventually went back to this idea I had of the library after I got tenure. Of course, I already had a job, so he couldn't. But then I went back and went and started thinking about the library as a religious, or its past as a religious institution. And started applying this Marxist theory and dialectical method to it in order to better understand it. And I did out of that came a chapter in a book on class and librarianship for Library Juice Press. So I eventually decided to expand on that chapter to create a monograph starting around 2019. I was doing that. And then COVID hit. And that really threw a wrench into the whole thing. And I ended up with a big pile of words. So after I was almost on the verge of just giving up on it. But then Wendy, she came and she was a former editor for Journal of Academic Librarianship and the college and College and Research Libraries. And she really came in and helped me figure out what I was doing and reframe it and develop into what it ended up being. So it's been a long, long journey. And I just can't wait to send a copy to my committee chair.
Yeah. Yeah. Great to let them know that you finally got back to it and it worked out okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about what is in this book. So you start off by giving us a history of libraries from ancient times. And in chapters 1 and 2, we learn about libraries in the Bronze Age, the Iron Age, and then through late antiquity and the Middle Ages. you don't have to go into all the details of this narrative. You know, people can read the book, but, you know, give as many examples as you think is helpful. I'm curious if you could explain what you see as the like core constitutional makeup of information institutions that we see emerge out of that era, what their role was in society, and what characteristics of libraries we can trace back to that time.
Yeah, so I think that information institutions have been around for several thousand years now, but they, when they first, like writing has always been, language and writing has always been seen as holy or divine. The first writing, ironically, was meant for creating like business records, which I always found interesting and strange and kind of depressing, or like writing receipts for sheep carcasses, things like that. And so eventually they had to organize all of these records to keep track of all of these business transactions, but the actual task of learning how to write was very, very difficult, and writing was thought as holy or divine. And so the actual people who were tasked with collecting this information, writing it down, collecting it, and organizing it were, and for the most part, they were religious functionaries. Right? They were priests, scribes were priests. So the library started out, or these organizations of information, for the most part, started out as religious institutions. I mean, there were libraries found in palaces, but in these civilizations, ancient Sumerian and Egyptians and Greek civilizations, the ruler was seen essentially as a religious figure as well, right? So all this information was created in a religious context, organized by religious functionaries. And the purpose began to develop into maintaining what, like, there's this Sumerian or Assyriologist named Elio Oppenheim, who said that the purpose of this development or these institutions was to maintain what was called the stream of tradition, right? So to maintain these scribes who were an elite, basically an elite caste in society almost, maintain their position in society and to maintain society throughout the ages through the stream of tradition. And it worked wildly well. I mean, if you look at the length of time that the Egypt and Sumeria, they were around, this idea worked wildly well. So these original institutions, which I call proto-libraries in the book, they were developed to sort of as conservative institutions to maintain society, to maintain the hierarchical, patriarchal nature of society. Now that's pretty much one of the means to do this was through religious ideology, and that pretty much is what has remained the case and that's my argument in this book to the present day. I mean, in Greece, in the classical Greece, there is some advances in literacy, right, through the introduction of the alphabet, then we have after that we have the more people reading and writing more texts. We have more larger library collections. And then we have people like Aristotle. So I think that while that's the basic constitution of the library is a religious organization for maintaining culture and society ideology. At one point with Aristotle, we have a shift, right? And what I call these earlier institutions proto-libraries. But with Aristotle, what we see is his philosophies, he basically came up with a systematic way for producing knowledge through his scientific work and his logical work, right? And what happened was Ptolemy, the first pharaoh of Egypt, what he decided to do is create something fantastic to really show off Egypt. So, and he thought show off Egypt and also Greek culture. So what he decided to do, having been a student of Aristotle, was to create the best library he could. Right. And this library, and he imported all of these Aristotelian thinkers. Demetrius of Phalerum was the sort of the mastermind behind organizing the library. And he was an Aristotelian thinker himself. And he organized the library around Aristotelian principles as a means for engaging in the type of research methods that Aristotle had written about, this dialectical logical approach, which involves taking the opinions of esteemed people and then working through them dialectically in order to create new knowledge. And so to do this, you need a library. Aristotle used his library for doing this. And so this just seemed natural for Demetrius. So Aristotle can be seen as like the first thinker to actually write down something close to a philosophy, library philosophy, in the Library of Alexandria, the first place or the first institution to actually put that into action, right? So I see it as moving with the Library of Alexandria is moving from a primary purpose of the institution is to maintain the stream of tradition, cultural preservation, to while the Library of Alexandria certainly did these things, it also is profound in that it served as a means for creating new knowledge. That was its primary goal. But underneath all of this, even though the library is Library of Alexandria is something new, its basic foundation remains the same. I noticed it's a temple to the muses. I mean, it was attached to the museum, which is a temple to the muses. The head of the Library of Alexandria was a religious priest, and it maintained things like the hierarchical patriarchal structure, monumental architecture. It was seen as a living, the place where the holy actually lived, right? So throughout history, the libraries and information institutions were religious institutions and very visible religious institutions until only very, very recently, the last few hundred years.
Yeah, well, getting into quote unquote recent history, in chapter 3, you start looking at university libraries around the 12th century. And so what was the social context for those kinds of libraries, and how was that a shift from the libraries and proto-libraries that we've talked about? I guess, like, what characteristics did they inherit from the institutions we've talked about already, but also how does this whole process of evolution bring us to what you've labeled in this book as the modern capitalist academic library?
Yeah, so I think that at the end of, so at the end of antiquity, in the during late antiquity, the libraries, like the big, in quotes, academic libraries, like the Library of Alexandria and in the Serapeum, they started seeing really like hard times. Like the Serapeum was looted and pretty much destroyed, and we fell into society, Western society fell into the basically the Dark Ages, where literacy dropped, and these information institutions actually tended to regress from this this ideal of the library of Alexandria that I put forth, back to something more akin to a proto-library, right? So the libraries were basically kept in monasteries, right? So they reverted back to these religious, they've always been religious institutions, but they were religious institutions, and basically they were kept apart from the wider culture in these monasteries, that sort of the libraries were under the firm grip of the church for a long time, for many, many years. And because they had to face all these things like the cataclysms and people trying to just get their books and everything else. And so they were basically fortresses built up to protect the monks and the information. And when the church really needs to be credited for doing that, or for the fact that we have a lot of that information today, crediting these monastery libraries, but there was a definite regression. But later in the later high Middle Ages, these monasteries, in addition to the monasteries, places for education became like cathedrals. So people started going to cathedrals for their religious education, and therefore we started seeing larger libraries, academic libraries. And then in about the 12th century, we have what's called, referred to as the 12th century Renaissance. Most people think of the later Italian Renaissance, but there's actually in the 12th century, there was a Renaissance in education. And during this time, thinking the thoughts of like philosophers, philosophical works of like Aristotle were starting to be reintroduced, people and the scholars were getting a hold of these things. And generally the time, high Middle Ages, where things had calmed down, it was a lot easier to survive, just basic survival wasn't as big of a problem, right? So we had, there was more opportunity for study. We have scholars moving around between cities studying. And so these students, what they ended up doing was banding, it was still dangerous being a student. And the church still had a lot of power over scholarship, right? So what these students started doing to protect their best interests was to band together into these sort of corporate entities. And that's what the first Western universities, and what we get the modern West universities today from, are these students that would band together so that, that it was harder to rob them or rip them off or it was easier for them to challenge the church in order to engage in scholarship. And so in about 1088 CE, we have the first university it's the University of Bologna. And then by 1500, there was like at least 70 different universities. We see the shift actually moving from the monastery libraries, this opening up, right, through the universities and through education, and this almost a shift backwards, looking to the past, and the role again of these, while the universities were still very much affected by religion and the church, we see this movement towards, again, towards the creation of knowledge as the role of the education. And therefore, these university libraries were developed in order to, again, serve this creation of knowledge. In the Renaissance, we see that while the church is still powerful, we see it, the religion moving back more and more into the background in terms of the academic university and the library. And then with the Enlightenment, we get ideas, big ideas that which are moving away, these big abstract ideas which are moving towards the secular, and these include things like intellectual freedom, individual liberty, freedom of inquiry, right? And we start seeing the first nominally secular universities and academic libraries. But while we're seeing these nominally secular, this transition, this structure, this religious basis, this residual culture is still there, right? And it's being covered up by this sort of secular patina, but it's still there, right? And we also see a move from feudalism as the mode of production, right, to capitalism as the mode of production. Right. And one thing that capitalism loves to do is to take advantage of defunct ideology for the purpose of advancing capitalism. Right. So capitalism, while we have these secular institutions, capitalism is able to pillage all the best parts of this previous religious ideology, which was the primary ideology. So the church, we move from church to these capitalist ideas, and education actually being a primary ideology instead of religion. But capitalism is able to take the best parts of religion in order to further itself. So when we have these universities and their academic libraries, we see things like hierarchy, right? The hierarchy remains pretty much the same. It's basic Christian, Catholic, Roman Catholic hierarchy that we see in the university and in library faculties that have tenure status. We see the same Catholic hierarchy with the, you can see the library dean is in the position of the Pope, all the way down to priests, many different orders of priests, and you can see patrons as actual lay people. And so the capitalism maintains the best parts that that they can apply to these institutions in order to reproduce capitalism. So that's what the MCAL is the modern capitalist academic library.
Yeah, it's super fascinating for me in reading this to see these threads emerge through history that are very recognizable to me today, but we don't always think about where they're coming from. So then in chapter four, you explain the metaphor that really grounds this book, Serapis and the Serapeum. Could you explain for listeners who Serapis was and what you mean exactly when you speak of the Serapian Library? And then I would love if you could share how you see a concrete example of the Serapian Library in Hodges Library at University of Tennessee, Knoxville.
Yeah, so Serapis, so most people, they know about the Library of Alexandria, the Great Library of Alexandria, which was created by the Ptolemy I in Egypt. But and not as famous as the Great Library of Alexandria is its daughter library, which was created by, they think, by his son, Ptolemy II. And its namesake, it's named after a god, Serapis, and it actually, the Serapeum is the temple to Serapis. And what Serapis was, is a Greco-Egyptian composite god. There is some mention, very brief mentions of a god named Serapis earlier than the Ptolemies. But what Ptolemy did was he's a master politician, right? So he was the first Greek emperor of, or Greek pharaoh of Egypt. And he was the buddy of Alexander the Great. So when Alexander the Great died, he left Ptolemy's stayed in Egypt and became the pharaoh of Egypt. And Ptolemy decided that he needed a way to consolidate his rule over Egypt and build his legitimacy, right, over the local Egyptian politician, because there were all these Greeks coming into Egypt. So what he did was he took this, and he had a dream, supposedly, had a dream of this god Serapis, from this dream, he was told by his advisors that he needed to go. Serapis was his statue was in a place called Sinope, and I believe it's in the Asia, Turkey, modern day Turkey, and he needed to go get that statue. So he went and got the statue and presented it to the Greeks and Egyptians in Egypt and saying this was the god revealed to him in a dream. And it was a combination god. It was like a composite between Osiris, the god of fertility, and the god of death and the afterlife, and Apis, who is another Egyptian god, who just happened to be very closely linked to the pharaohs before Ptolemy, and combine those with Greek gods like primarily Pluto and Zeus to create a composite god that looked in its iconography is a Greek, but also had all of these symbols and elements that the Egyptians, the native Egyptian population, would relate to, right? So this was a very savvy PR move on Ptolemy's part, and was an attempt to impose Greek culture in Egypt through not so well known new symbols, but also very familiar symbols, right? And it worked. It worked really well. Became a very potent symbol of the hegemony of the Ptolemies, and the identity of Alexandria became essentially the main god of Alexandrian Egypt. So the actual Serapeum itself was the primary temple to Serapis. It was in the Egyptian quarter of Alexandria. The Great Library was in the Greek quarter, but they decided to build the temple of Serapis, who has this Egyptian ancestry, along with his Greek ancestry, in the Egyptian quarter of Alexandria. And it was built around the mid-third century by Ptolemy II. on the only hill in Alexandria. So most Greek temples are built on acropolises, acropoli. But so the Serapeum was built on the Acropolis in Alexandria. I think it's actually an artificial man-made hill, but they built it there. And in this, there was a library, which seemed to be was pretty much a natural thing that you would find in any temple in the ancient world, right? So you found it in the Great Library of Alexandria. Ptolemy the First, when he was out campaigning with Alexandria, he saw all these gigantic Sumerian libraries in these monumental architecture. So he started building them himself in these big temples, right? And so the Serapeum itself, it was a massive library. Some people, it's estimated that it had between 40,000 and 300,000 scrolls. So some think it maybe had about half as many scrolls as the Great Library of Alexandria, and it served as a place for, it was almost a branch library of the Library of Alexandria where scholars would come in order to do science and art. And for hundreds of years, it was a center of learning. The Great Library of Alexandria possibly was destroyed before it. So the Serapeum actually took over the role of the Great Library of Alexandria, possibly, until about 391 BC. In 391 BCE, that's when Theodosius the Great closed all the pagan temples, which the Serapeum was. And so the Christian mob formed and rushed the hill and looted the Serapeum, burnt pretty much everything to the ground, or converted it into Christian churches. And that was pretty much it for that. But we decided to use the Serapeum as a metaphor because we see Serapis, the god, is embodying the ideologies of both religion and state, and the Serapeum as doing both of these things, as being an exemplar of the library as an institution, which embodies the ideologies of religion and state, but also incorporating abstract philosophical and conceptual principles such as knowledge, the search for truth, and cultural preservation.
Right? Yeah.
So we can pretty much, that has served as the model of the library, the academic library, since, right? This sort of nexus between state, religion, and information organization. Pretty much to this day, but the actual, you know, the religion part is not as visible, but it's still there, and it still maintains a presence, and it still maintains an ideological force.
And I'm curious, you use UT Knoxville as an example of this. I mean, you don't have to go into all the detail of, but I'm curious if you could, you know, give a few examples of elements of this that you see at UT Knoxville and Hodges Library.
So the Hodges Library is one of the clearest examples of the religious symbolism in architecture that I've seen. It was designed for a long time, it just looked like a large building. But in the 80s, they decided that they were going to really outdo themselves, and they built a structure around. They had this smallish undergraduate library, and they decided to make it the main library on campus. And they rebuilt it basically into the modeled after a Sumerian ziggurat, which is a Sumerian temple, Mircea Eliade, the religious historian, he was quite clear that these ziggurats, these seven-story pyramids, stepped pyramids where they were performed, they would have a shrine at the top on the seventh story. He called these clear examples of what he called cosmic mountains, right? And a cosmic mountain sits at sort of the place where heaven touches earth. And the pinnacle of the cosmic mountain represents where this interface between heaven and earth. He also calls this an axis mundi. And so I took one look at Hodges Library and I said, that's an axis mundi. I mean, that's a cosmic mountain. And, but what are, I mean, it's where the holy meets the earth, where we interface with it, where we, you know, come face to face with this cosmic reality, this divinity, the sacred reality. And then I started thinking about, well, what is the sacred reality in this academic library? How's it expressed? So if we go into Hodges Library, we see a secular priesthood, more or less, in the form of a professional libraries who are hierarchically structured in the same way that priests have been structured for the past 2,000 years. And the first thing you notice when you walk into Hodges Library is the quiet, right? So you recognize there's sort of this moving from profane space to sacred space. So that's the first thing you notice. And even though the quiet is no longer really encouraged in Hodges Library, particularly when you go in through the main entrance, because they're trying to adopt, or they have adopted this this Library Commons model, that's what you get. I thought, why does that happen? I mean, why do people default to quiet when they go into the library? And that's because the library is telling you, as a symbol, to be quiet, right? And it is also telling you through other symbols that are related to religion, that are derived from this religious history, how to act in the library and how to approach the library and how you as a person relate to the library and are actually created by the library. So what the library is doing is it's using these symbols. And every institution does this in some way, using symbols in order to tell you your place within the actual institution itself. So you get put into a hierarchical arrangement. You become a lay person. You engage in the rituals of the library, which are handed down, being quiet. And there's also a Holy of Holies, right? And when we have the book stacks, now the book stacks are different than, you know, there's not a place where God lives, but there's book stacks represent a substitute for a God, like a Abrahamic God or whatever, the Sumerian God. They represent an abstract ideal. In this case, they would be academics libraries. They would be knowledge, right? The Holy of Holies represents this thing, knowledge that in a secular world, we have replaced the former occupant of the temple, the god or gods, with. But basically, it's doing the same thing. It's serving as sort of it's sitting at the top of this hierarchy that the library is reinforcing. This picture of the cosmos, which the library has throughout time as a temple, and now as a more or less a secular temple, is imposing on us. The library as a as an axis mundi is telling us, it's a reflection of the cosmos, and through these symbols it's telling us how we need to act, our relationship with the library, what we're allowed to do, what we're not allowed to do, what's taboo in it, in its usage.
Yeah, and I don't think we talk a lot about, you know, how we subconsciously read those, like, symbols and rituals in the architecture and behavior of these spaces. You analyze that a lot more in chapters 5 and 6. And I don't know if there's more examples that you want to give of how this kind of library reinforces ideological structures with, like, different symbols and rituals that you discussed in those chapters.
Yeah, so what we did was we looked at, as a lens, theory of ideology, which was developed by a Marxist thinker named Louis, a French Marxist thinker, did most of his work in the 1960s and 70s. His name is Louis Althusser, and he conceived ideology as a material thing. So this is a very Marxist idea, right? So ideology could be conceived as material, right? Ideas can be seen as material, as well as physical things. And what Althusser said, that what we have in society, in order to reproduce society in the mode of production of that society, which is currently capitalism, because you and the people who are, in power, the elites under capitalism, don't really want you to reproduce something else, like a socialist society or a feudal society. Right? So built into our institutions, we have a means of reproducing these ideologies that will keep capitalism rolling. Right. So what Althusser, he came up with this idea of what he called ideological state apparatuses. Right. So we have what are called repressive state apparatus, and this would actually be the state itself, which uses violence, primarily violence, in order to keep people in line, things like the police and the military. But in order to reproduce ideology, the capitalist state is a lot more savvy about that. It doesn't use violence. It uses these ideological state apparatuses, things like the educational system, the political system, religious institutions, legal institutions, and it uses these institutions, which he calls ideological state apparatuses, to reproduce ideology, the ideology of capitalism. Right. So, if you look at the academic library, it's pretty much it's an educational ideological state apparatus. People go to college, they get a degree so they can get a job and function in society and reproduce society. But then it's also, if you look past that, you can see that it's also several different others, it contains elements of several different others ideological apparatuses, including like the cultural apparatus, and culture and arts, and the religious apparatus, that's what I'm arguing in this book, basically, is that this apparatus is there and it's still very, very much alive. So what Althusser said was that the way that ideology works is when you come into contact with ideology through these ideological state apparatuses, what happens is you enter a relationship with the ideology. Right? Althusser didn't really believe in the individual self, right? There's nothing that makes us individual, no human nature. So what happens is these, what we are composed of, what ideologies tell us we are. So when we come into contact with the symbols in these, in the modern capitalist academic libraries, these symbols are ways of relating or having the ideologies behind these symbols tell us who we are, what we need to be doing, what our place is in society, right? So the primary symbols have to do with education, but then we have all of these religious symbols as well, these thinly veiled, in many cases, religious symbols. So some of the examples that I talked about before were things like statuary. We see oftentimes names of very important intellectuals are inscribed into the actual buildings themselves or their statuaries. Usually they're male, which also shows you how this ideology is reproducing capitalist ideology and patriarchy. We see things like classification systems, which have been used, which tell us basically the representations of the cosmos and reality. And they are clearly, like in the case of the Dewey Decimal classification, based on Judeo-Christian ideologies, right? So what happens is when we come into contact with these things and we react, we don't, they build our sense of how they actually build us, right? The actual institution, as well as all the other institutions in society, all of our relationships make us. Without those, we wouldn't be anything at all. And that's what the library is doing through its symbols and what it's telling us through these religious symbols. And so one example that I use in the book, it's kind of like kind of a fanciful example, is this idea of library anxiety. Right? So what is the library? Library anxiety is this anxiety students, anybody really feels when they come into contact the library, when they go into the library or even think about the library. A lot of people don't actually go to the library because of library anxiety. So what is library anxiety? Well, if you analyze it ideologically, right, you can make the case that library anxiety is caused by our encounter with these symbols, these ideological symbols, which are telling us how to be in the library. And if we believe that these religion, this residual religious ideology is telling us to do things, what are these symbols telling us to do? And if we look at an idea of what going into a sacred space does to us, to human beings, and these ideas of like religious anxiety, and Rudolf Otto, a theologian, called this mysterium tremens or mysterium tremendens, this idea that we cower in the face of the holy, we can posit this as sort of as an explanation for library anxiety, as a, you know, that's what we're doing. We're being told what to do by the library, which is interesting because everybody is always trying to think of ways to counter library anxiety. But actually, if we look at it through an ideological lens, the library is doing what it's supposed to do. Right? It's telling us our place in society. Right? Ideologically, what's happening is what's supposed to happen.
Yeah, that was a really, really fascinating connection that you draw in the book. And I was so glad that you wrote about like library anxiety. And I think this gives us really different ways to talk about it and talk about like what the real problem is, I guess. So moving to your last chapter, you talk about the actual people who work in libraries, and you introduce us to the cynical library worker as well as the cynical library worker. So could you explain those two types and discuss how you envision the clinical library worker as someone who could respond to and challenge the dominant ideological structures found in the modern capitalist academic library.
Yeah, so when most people think about cynicism, they think about sort of like the belief that people are motivated by self-interest, kind of the dictionary definition of cynicism. But cynicism as a philosophy dates back to the mid 4th century BCE, and the main force behind this type of cynicism was this guy named Diogenes of Sinope, and he lived in the agora of Athens, in the marketplace of Athens, and he lived in a big clay pot in the agora, and he was famous for sort of poking holes into the power structures of the powerful people of Athenian democracy, right? And he would do all kinds of like outlandish things in order to do this. There's stories of him like insulting Alexander the Great and peeing on somebody's leg to make a point. But that was his goal. He wasn't doing it just because he hated people, but he wanted to point out the absurdities in this ideology of this time, this Athenian ideology of Athenian democracy at the time, all right? And so this was the philosophical school of cynicism. And then in the 70s, this writer, Peter Sloterdijk, he did a study of cynicism, and he said he came up with this concept of modern cynics. Right? He said that while a philosophical cynic understands this power of ideology and the absurdities of the political structure and elements of culture, he said that nowadays what we have are modern cynics, and modern cynics understand this, right? They understand the absurdity, but they're disillusioned, and therefore they become a part of the system of repression that we are taking part in, that we're living in. And then following on that, there was a Slovenian philosopher, Slavoj Zizek. He took this idea and he said that, well, if we have these modern cynics, opposed to that, what we need are modern kinics. And he began with a K to differentiate them from cynics. And that what he said was a kinic is more akin to the project that Diogenes was doing. And a kinic is someone who observes the existence of ideological structures and then actively struggles against the repressive structures. Right? So while a modern cynic is just understands what's going on, but they're part of the system, the kinic actually actively works against these structures. So the modern kinic's he called it a lived ideological critique, with the goal of human emancipation. So it's really a successor to this, what Diogenes was doing it. And so most modern library workers, I would not classify as modern cynics in the sense that Peter Sloterdijk was. But many are, while they have this feeling of unease, they are not really fully understand these ideological elements that they're dealing with. So the goal, in my opinion, of the modern kinic in the academic library is to take these people and take oneself into achieve a critical consciousness of ideologies, and also to achieve some sense of reflexivity in this system. So to understand how they, as they contribute to this reproduction of ideologies, right, and what they can do in order to counter this. Right, and understand, you know, what the roles of things like professionalization means, the downside, like the downsides of professionalization, things like the esotericization of information, and how do we, as modern kinics, or kinical librarians, how do we confront this and struggle against it? So the main tool of the modern, or the main tool of the philosophical, the classical cynic, was something called paresia, and that means freedom of speech. So this should be our primary tool as kinical librarians. And paresia means using speech to break through mental confusion, right? And specifically using provocative dialogue that borders on the transgressive, right? So that's what I think that the librarian today has to do. They have to analyze the library, understand the library ideologically, right, in terms of its religious history, in terms of these other ideologies, what these ideologies are doing, how they're maintaining society, and then speak the truth to power, right? Break through this mental confusion, which there was a word for that called tufos, the smoke. What we're trying to do is clear the smoke, and also to engage in material action, right? And to actively work to restructure the institutions that we work in, right? So not only the institutions, but the larger society to become, and this is one writer that I read has this fabulous thing saying that we should need to become modern heretics, right? So we need to forsake the sacred, identify the sacred, but understand how the sacred is impacting our lives, impacting our work, and then move beyond that, to see the whole story in order to change the story.
Yeah, it's exciting to read something that like acknowledges our disillusionment and gives us ideas for moving beyond that. Well, I've taken a lot of your time, but before we wrap up, I would love if you could share a little bit about what you're working on next. If there's any new projects you have that maybe have emerged from this book or completely different research you're diving into.
Yeah, so I'm working with Tina Budzeis Weaver. She is another former academic librarian here at Texas A&M University. Now she's faculty in performance studies here. And we are writing a book. What we're doing is we're doing interviews of library workers, either workers or scholars or both, that are engage in critical librarianship, right, who look at the library critically and its cultural aspects. And what we're doing is we're interviewing these people and we're asking them to tell us about some sort of seminal intellectual product in their professional makeup, which has guided them in their work as critical thinkers. So we've asked them to pick one seminal intellectual object or artistic object. It could be a thing like a journal article or a book, not necessarily even an academic book. It could be a novel. It could be a work of art, music, an album, something that they feel has really helped form their critical consciousness and propelled their work. And so what we're doing is that we're interviewing them, and then we're discussing this item and to sort of build a bibliography of these things.
That sounds really cool. Will that come in some like book form or some digital form or?
This will be a book, hopefully in 2000, I think it's scheduled in 2014 for publication. Yeah. We're right at the beginning though. Or not 2014. See, I'm always thinking about the past, 2024. Yeah.
Super. Well, thank you so much for chatting about this. I really enjoyed our conversation. Once again, I've been speaking with Stephen Bales, co-author of Serapis, The Sacred Library and Its Declericalization, published by Library Juice Press. My name is Jen Hoyer, and you've been listening to New Books Network.